Hello, welcome to Waldman's Words with Emily Burke and Chris Foytel, who will be joining us in a few minutes.
Yeah, it's my last episode before I'm gone forever.
I was going to say it. It was going to sound so much. It's kind of like if I tell you that my metaphorical son is really smart, it means a lot more when someone else compliments my metaphorical son. Let's try this again. It's your last day.
It is.
What kind of food are we eating after this?
A Thai food. I'm very excited.
I'm excited too. I'm not sure if I'm more excited about the pad see you or Chris Foytel to my left right now, because this interview, I'm going to learn quite a bit.
It's just an exciting day today.
Hey, again though, what label do you intern for? Just quick shout out.
Oh, well, I was an intern at Epitaph.
R.I.P.?
Yeah.
Well, I just want to let you know that this will be the last ass-kissing I do for the show, but Epitaph is literally the label that introduced me to punk rock. I can talk about Offspring, NOFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, Descendants. The list goes on and on, so it's a big deal for me that Chris is here right now. He doesn't have to be, and neither do you.
That's true, but you know what? I like it. This has been fun and great. Well, I have good things to say.
You are our last guest on the show.
That's
so
true,
this
yeah.
is
going
to be slightly different.
I know. He's coming right after my episode, so you have a lot to live up to.
Or a lot to live down to.
Oh.
The double Epitaph whammy. So I guess who are the next few guests for the next few weeks?
Well, we have Will Stevenson.
Yes, he's going to be
in
on.
The next 2 weeks.
Yes. And let's do it in reverse order.
Yeah, that was the first one I remembered. And then Brad Dillon.
Yes, Brad Dillon has a blog called The New Fury, which covers lots of young, hungry, and old and still hungry bands. And he's a really nice guy, a really talented writer, and I'm stoked to have him on the show. That's going to be a call-in guest. And we've got Will Stevenson of Artery, which has launched many, many bands, namely Attila. So I'm just stoked for the next few weeks. We're booked out. What's crazy is by the time this episode airs, I'll be back, but I'm going to France on Sunday. So a band that used to be on Fearless, or maybe still is, Chunk No Captain Chunk, I believe, is from France. So kind of like the French A Day to Remember.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting them.
I would agree. I think Chris is kind of nodding at that, so that makes me excited. So every single Tuesday night, 5 o'clock hour Pacific time, 8 o'clock Eastern time, where you will be, and I will be lamenting your loss, and so is Epitaph.
I'm sure. What time does it air in Paris? Do you know?
It airs at pretentious o'clock. Okay. I don't know the exact time. I think that on the East Coast, it's obviously 3 hours, and I believe it's about like a 5-6 hour flight from there. We thankfully have a direct flight, because that would, connecting flights are the bane of my existence, okay. And I'm sure you can relate to that. There. And the luggage lost, what the fuck, go. So I believe it's going to be 6 hours later, so I might listen to this in Paris while my wife thinks I'm a narcissist.
Yeah, I mean, I would.
I would do the same thing. So let's finish this brief thought before we interrogate the hell out of Chris Foytel. The badass thing is that every Tuesday night, 5 o'clock our time, 8 o'clock your time, and Sundays, let's give Sundays a shout out.
Sundays is 5 a.m. Pacific and then 8 a.m. Eastern.
And pretentious o'clock French time.
Yeah, exactly. I'll set my alarm for that.
Does the alarm have, I'm trying to think, it would probably have like a Radiohead song as it goes off or something.
I'll figure out how to do that. I'm not very good with my technology.
It's a good thing to admit when the label guys here that you worked for that you're not good at technology. As for the record, I'm just going to say that Emily is a badass with technology and showed me how to literally record this audition just now. So thank you. Thank you. We got one person applauding in this room. So stick around for Chris Foytel, Emily Burke's last in-house episode, and my first episode where I might cry on the air. Hello, I hope you enjoyed those commercials slash songs. We are in the studio with Emily Burke and Chris Foytel. Great. Say who you are.
Great to be here. Always a pleasure to be with Scott Waldman and a past intern for my Epitaph Records. Scott and I have known each other for a very long time now, and I'm very excited that he's ventured into, well, many different facets of the industry, but especially doing the show, because I think it's awesome that he brings in like-minded people that can kind of share what we do right and what we do wrong.
I try to highlight the right and scold the wrong. That's what I try to do. And I'll just say this very quickly. I moved to Los Angeles, and shortly after I did, I joined a band called The City Drive. And shortly after that, I met Chris when he was actually working for Epic Records. So this music community, some people stay in it for a long time, and I'm new to the suit side, as you can tell by my current outfit.
Oh, yeah.
So I got decked out. I wore the sandals for you to resonate with the beach going public. But let's go down. Are you born and raised in Agora?
I was actually born in San Luis Obispo.
Oh, even slower pace. I like that.
Yeah, literally. Slow.
Yeah. Oh, shit.
But I only lived there till I was about five. My parents are both from Los Angeles.
Okay.
And they lived up there because my dad opened up a restaurant. So, but yeah, for all intents and purposes, I was raised in Agora Hills.
Well, I just want to say that SLO Brew is a sick venue. And how far is Pismo from there?
It's very close. It's probably 15 minutes away.
The best clam chowder I've had west of Massachusetts was there.
Yeah, the best show I saw at Slow Brew was Over It.
Oh!
Probably 2005, give or take.
So like Lobster, when Silver Strand was out and all that stuff?
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty sweet. Do you know who Over It is?
I don't.
Well, they're basically a pop punk band that never really took off, but then they turned into a pop band. And I say pop as like total pop. They were called
Run.
Yeah, I would argue it was pretty bubblegum. I really liked Over It. I actually liked their major label record, Step Outside Yourself, too. But it's funny, we were actually having a conversation outside. We won't name drop, but about certain songs that just never pop off. And that's one that I believe should have, so...
Yeah, no, that band, they had some really great tunes.
There are several sirens on the 101, weren't there?
Yeah.
So SLO, and what catalyzed your love for music? Because I learned this only recently that you actually play as well.
Yeah, so my family's very musical. My mom comes from a family of five brothers and sisters who almost all of them are very good guitar players and singers. I have a lot of cousins as well that are super talented. And then on my dad's side, my dad played piano for many years and then guitar as well. He actually lived in London for a while and would play in pubs there and hang out by Apple Studios, you know, hoping to get a glimpse of, you know, obviously the Fab Four.
Never heard of him.
But then when he moved back to L.A., after being in London studying abroad, he actually played keyboards a bit for Jan and Dean, who are a pretty well-known like surf rock band within that community.
And is that what catalyzed? I'm saying catalyzed to Tesla. I won't say it anymore. Is that what got you onto the board?
Yeah, I mean, when I was in third grade, I reluctantly started taking piano lessons.
Like most reluctant kids.
Yeah, but I stuck with it. Then when I got into junior high school, I started playing in jazz band. And that was cool just because there was a drummer and an electric guitarist and a bass player. And even though I've still to this day respect jazz, but I'd be lying if I said that I was very knowledgeable in the history and
same here, man.
It's like I like Thelonious Monk, I like Coltrane,
Davis.
Know? Yeah, but I'm not a jazz historian by any means. But it was rad because, you know, at the time, now being a keyboard player, well, it's all cyclical, but now keyboard players are highly sought out. Back then, keyboard players were like
kind of frowned upon.
Yeah, like, oh man.
And they were kind of resurrected.
Who wants a dorky keyboard player in their band?
Yeah, it's kind of like Zach Attack with the keytar, but it's funny that I would say, like, around the time I met you, there was a little bit of a resurrection of the keyboard in terms of, like, Motion City Soundtrack, and
but this was about 5 or 6 years.
Because we're old as fuck.
This is when Nirvana, Nevermind, and...
Oh, yeah, that's... So no
keys on that.
Yeah, there would be nary a key on that, and if it was, it was, like, behind in the mix on the record, so...
Yeah, but, you know, just kind of synopsis of all that, played... in jazz band all through junior high school, and then picked up the guitar as well. You know, my dad was able to show me just kind of the basic chords, and you know, got really into that and started playing in bands probably about like 7th, 8th grade. I mean, actual like bands that would, you know, play shows. I mean,
would you play talent shows? Is that what you would kind of do?
No, we'd play like in a youth group or like, you know, wherever we could party, you know, mm-hmm. house parties, or I guess there weren't many house parties. 8th grade, 9th grade. But like before that, it would just be a group of guys getting together in a room and jamming out.
Jazz band was awesome. I played bass in my high school jazz band, and I'm telling you, like, I'm on the same page as you in terms of my love for the music. I think it's good, but it's usually what a lot of guitar players who graduate to that genre, they think that that's what they're supposed to do because that means that you're an exceptional player, and it's not for everyone.
Well, which is pretty rad, which was pretty rad, was that our jazz teacher, well, the band teacher in general at my junior high school, Lindero Canyon Middle School, who's, I believe, still there, his name's Matt McKagan, and his brother is Duff McKagan.
Oh, GNR.
So, like, yeah, they would bring, you know, he would come in, and they'd bring other guests. Vince Trombetta, who was Jay Leno's tenor sax player for years and years, who actually
then
was
he's
my
good.
Private jazz piano teacher for a long time. There was a lot of really cool connections made through both the jazz program at Lindero and at Agora High School, where I continued to play mm-hmm. in jazz band.
Emma's from the Valley, too, just so you know.
From Woodland Hills.
Right on.
Yeah. Neighbors.
But, you know, throughout that period, I definitely became more passionate about guitar and then played in bands that just kind of follow the trends of what was going on in my personal, you know, all of our personal tastes, mm-hmm. You know, from ska to more my favorite band I ever played in high school, which again never really did like proper gigs. We might have done the Cobalt Cafe like once.
See, that's where Hoobastank got their start.
Yeah,
so
yeah. Well, that's the thing, those guys were big idols to us. They, because they're from the Agora area, mm-hmm. I remember, I think Dan Estrin,
guitar player,
and Doug the singer, either both or one of them were our after school YMCA counselor.
And they had a horn guy in the band originally. I think they were a 5-piece, so.
Yeah, yeah. No, they were like their early stuff was super experimental, like Primus, Mr. Bungle. Like
how Incubus kind of started. They kind of, I remember I was in college.
They definitely followed in Incubus footsteps.
Totally, and then they released The Reason, which was, I guess, their attempt of Drive. But what's kind of wild is that Drive didn't get as circulated with the moms. And every time I'm at a Ralph's, no fail, I hear The Reason.
Yeah.
It's that kind of stuff, which we could talk about Hoobastank at length on Hoobastank's words in a minute. So I guess when did you shift to being behind the scenes?
So that's a good question as well. I graduated and moved to San Diego for a couple years to do junior college.
Another slow pace place. You like that slow pace.
Yeah, you know,
that's
beach
dope.
Guy. Well, then I moved to New York, so I...
Oh, it's as slow as it gets there. We're not a mile a minute in New York.
Yeah. Moved to San Diego, was going to junior college down there, still playing guitar in bands, and at that time, that's when, like, Thrice's Identity Crisis came out. I mean, AFI was big, and funny enough, we can jump fast forward to this later, but...
There's no rules on Waldman's words.
I was going to junior college down there, playing in, like, heavier bands, and that's how I met the guys in Pierce the Veil, because our band would play with them at Teen Centers and the Epicenter, and
they were very similar. Lagwagon, I remember their older stuff, like really, really intricate.
We were all into skate punk. I mean, because we're all Southern California, we all skated, we all surfed, we all mm-hmm. smoked weed, and so it was like, yeah, Pennywise, Lagwagon, No Use for a Name, 10-foot pole, Strung Out.
I mean, Strung Out is as technically proficient as it gets. They're so fucking talented. And
yeah.
I guess let's get into this quickly because obviously it doesn't really resonate today, but those skate videos show so many people different bands, and that was kind of a gateway drug for many, not
especially
me.
Especially Epitaph.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Especially, I mean, for example.
Well, and kids, yeah.
Well, but kids, but, well, for both, actually.
It was a perfect storm because skateboarding was becoming popular, and you had like, you know, your 4-on-1 skate videos and like just a whole series of stuff. Yeah,
Pennywise was probably one of the bigger bands on those videos, and obviously their Epitaph. And what exposed me to Epitaph Records was I did not have a bigger brother, and I still don't, actually. That'd be weird if I just found out I did. And I was into Green Day, which showed me the Offspring, and I was at a record shop on Long Island, and it said Punk-O-Rama featuring The Offspring, this band Nofix that I never heard of, this band Bood Religion, and Rancid. I never heard of any of these bands. I bought it. And
you also were horrible at pronunciating things.
Awful. Awfuling. I still don't know how to read despite my English degree. That's why Emily helps me with every single email and proofreading.
Yeah.
So thank you, Emily.
You're welcome.
So I guess the skate culture, and you knew the guys. And was their old band, it was like Before Today, or what was that?
So when I first met them, they actually really liked the fact that I... The favorite band that I played in high school was called Rad Bones, and we literally just would play like Sublime style, mm-hmm. like dub music.
I heard a rumor that Sublime's big down here.
Yeah, just a bit. But anyways, the Pierce guys, you know, when we met, and I really like to jam dub and ska music on and reggae on the keyboard, mm-hmm. so I would go and just fuck around with them. But
are they our age? I don't even know. Okay,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, exactly.
We're 73 years old, Emily.
Yeah,
I only assumed.
Okay, well, you know what happens when you assume. You're actually not making an ass out of it because you're right. Continue.
But essentially, I knew that like my passion was not going to be to pursue a professional career playing in a band.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't think that I was... good enough, and frankly, I don't know, it's not out of, like, fear necessarily. I just, you know, I was going to junior college down there with the intention of transferring into, like, a Pepperdine, USC, Loyola. Like, I saw the more academic route for me.
I wish more people felt the way you did when they realized they're not good enough for it. I really do, because I was having this conversation the other day, and it's just, like, it's the least... modest industry in terms of performers and suits, and I wish that some people were just slightly more humble. So I appreciate you being like, you know,
like, I love music, I love melody.
You're a fan.
I can play, you know, by ear. I'm talented, but as far as like being in like a rock band, like, not that I like grew up in the slums, but I grew up in like upper middle class Agora Hills, like, and it worked for some other guys, but like I just never like. I didn't really have like a message or like a passion to like mm-hmm. be that guy. Anyways, so I didn't really know what like label. I mean, I knew what labels were, but I didn't know like the inner workings mm-hmm. of them. And I looked and researched a bunch of it and found out what A&R was. And I'm like, oh wow, that's
artist and repertoire.
Yeah,
I learned that just now.
Yeah, I still think that's a silly term.
It's an antiquated term, I honestly think, but it is what it is.
Yeah, whatever. It's here to stay.
We'll redefine it another day, and we're going to call it repertoire and artists, R&A.
Yeah. Assholes and robbers.
That's pretty accurate for some.
Someone when I worked at a major label told me that.
That actually makes sense. We'll take your money.
Yeah. But anyways, transferred into Loyola Marymount, moved back up to L.A., and got an internship at Epic Records my junior year. And that's right about when I think we met. I can't remember if I was actually... like a paid scout at that time when City Drive showcased at Swing House, or if I was an intern. But either way, that's...
You were with Pete Jaberga, and I literally remembered you in the room because, honestly, those showcases...
Yeah, Rodell was...
Rodell was my... I think the room was filled with whoever was doing sound, Rodell, who was the City Drive's manager.
Yeah.
We were a three-piece band at the time. You and Pete, that's it.
Yeah.
It's weird playing like a 3-4 song set list for three people. It's really weird.
I mean, showcases period are awkward, man.
So awkward.
Especially for rock bands. I mean, if it's someone that's just going to sit down and play piano and sing or play guitar and sing, that's one thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, when it's like even remotely aggressive, up-tempo stuff.
Which I would categorize our band as remotely aggressive. That would be the way that I would describe
it.
Totally.
Up-tempo. It's not, you know. So, and then I was really fortunate to meet Pete because he took me under his wing. Same with his now wife, Samantha, who was his assistant at the time back at Epic. And they just,
Don't get any ideas. I'm married.
I'm also, you're fine. You're fine.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. And now I feel really invalidated. Continue.
I mean, the thing that... The first second that I walked in that building on my first day of interning, I'm just like, okay, like, this is what I want. Like, this is amazing. And Epic, like, no disrespect to them now, but at that time, were a premier rock label. You know, I mean, putting out like the tail end of like the Ozzy Osbourne records, Audioslave, Incubus, which was like, you know, my favorite band growing up.
Dude, they're a huge influence
for
me.
Good Charlotte, Phantom Planet, Modest Mouse.
Quiet Drive.
Quiet Drive, yeah, my first signing. The Garden State soundtrack, The Fray, and the list goes on.
What about the Immortal stuff? Because that was through Epic, right? Or was
that was kind of like, that had already been, I think they had already like settled some type of situation where...
Because Incubus, I think, started on that. I know that Korn was that, right?
Yeah, and I knew Jason Markey, who was at Immortal, and Happy Walters, and whatnot. But yeah, that was just, I think Immortal just kind of got cut in on those records. But it was all Epic.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Pete took me under his wing and really, you know, showed me the ropes, you know, of how labels work and how A&R works. And, you know, I did myself a lot of favors by being, you know, entrenched in the LA scene and knowing... you know, what was going on, and just I just went to shows because that's what I like to do.
And you were young and you had the stamina to do it.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, fast forward a little bit, I got hired to be a scout for them, which was pretty rad because my senior year of college, I was getting paid by a record label. I mean, even though it was a nominal, you know, salary, I was pretty stoked, and everyone at my school...
I worked at an eyeglass store my senior year in college, yeah. So...
Everyone, all my friends at college were pretty,
I mean, you were getting sampler CDs at that time a lot, too, before,
yeah.
Like, I had a buddy who is a scout, I believe, for Atlantic, and he would get so many CDs, and this is when, like, it would be the one that, say, for promotional use only, and this was, like, months before a record came out, so.
Oh, yeah, I had a shitload of CDs, but, So Quiet Drive was the first band that I signed to Epic. Love those guys. You know, they had such good songs, and you know, they're
Rise from the Ashes, dude.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a great cover of Time After Time. Unfortunately, if I was running the label, I wouldn't have had that be the radio single that we took a swing with. But you know, politics are politics, and we actually had signed Cartel. At a similar
honestly, that time. Was a good move.
I didn't sign Cartel. I was always respectful of what they did.
They were a militia group. We were just talking about militia group.
They were. But anyways, yeah, so signed Quiet Drive. That was a great first experience, especially to work with Chris Lord-Alge to mix the record. That was awesome.
That's insane.
Mixed, like, you know, this at that time, you know, the big All-American Rejects records, amongst many others. And then as a lot of instances like this happened to major labels, the regime change happened.
Was that when Sony was taking Columbia and Epic? I'm not 100% certain.
They merged with... I was there through the merger with BMG.
Okay.
When it all came under one umbrella, Columbia and RCA and Epic and a few other... and Arista, I think. But I left, I can't remember, I think it was like in 2006,
mm-hmm.
And then I, through my contacts that I had made at Epic, had a lot of people in my corner that were going to bat for me, and it just so happens that the two people that I was interviewing with were A&R executives at New York-based companies, well, at the New York offices of mm-hmm. major companies, Atlantic,
yep.
and Warner Brothers. And so I was, I'd gone to New York quite a bit, actually, when I was at Sony, because their headquarters were there, and every time we'd showcase a band, I'd fly out there. So it's pretty familiar with the city, you know, being...
It's a very quiet place.
Yeah. at 25, you know, I had been there probably 15 times. So ended up taking a job at Atlantic, packed up everything in Venice and moved out there when I was 25.
Did you move solo there?
I actually met through a family friend, oddly enough, who then went on to be the officiant in my wedding. Like, we're like best friends now, but...
I'm doing that on Saturday, by the way.
Yeah, it was one of those things where like my mom's like, oh, I was at this luncheon and you gotta like, you know, I was talking to this woman and her son lives in New York and works for ESPN and... you got to meet him. He needs a roommate. I'm just like, whatever, Mom. Like, you know, I'll find my own place out there. And
sure stop enough, bothering me, Bob.
Yeah, sure enough, you know, they paid for a couple trips for me to go out there and scout out apartments, and ended up moving in with my buddy Frank. And yeah.
Did you live with him for the duration of your time there?
Yeah, all 4 years.
Because real estate is really cheap there, right, in New York City. Yeah. Like, you get a lot of bang for your buck.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's about as big as this room.
And just so you guys know, this room is 83 stories wide. He is being, yeah. No, this room is quite small. We can smell each other. I actually brought Ever and Breath Mints for that, and they do not promote this company. So we're going to take a short break, and we're going to discuss the inner workings of working for another major label. And then Chris made the literal punk rock move and shifted to another, I guess, an independent arena. So, Emily, quick adjective to describe... Because we didn't do it in the preamble.
No.
So what do you think that the next little 22.5-minute session is going to be?
Interesting. It's a good one. I don't think I've used that one.
You haven't. And interesting is normally a word I use to describe an ugly painting, but I will accept it.
Yeah.
I'm going to say chill because, like, you're bringing me – like, no one's ever called me chill my whole life, and you are chill. So thank you for that. So stick around. We will be right back with Waldman's Words featuring Emily Burke's last in-studio appearance and featuring the wonderfully gifted Chris Foytel. We're back with the most chilled out Waldman's Words of all time with Chris Foytel, who, by the way, I fist bumped earlier. I learned that that's a new term. Fist pounding is not cool.
Yeah, you saying it slow like that is
not creepy.
No,
it's not creepy. So kids, come to my van. All right. So at any rate, we're back with Waldman's Words with Chris Foytel and Emily Burke. Let's talk more about New York City and Atlantic. But first, let's give Mamoon's a shout out for having some of the best falafels of all time in St. Mark's Place, and also Lombardi's, America's first pizzeria.
Lombardi's is great. That was definitely a go-to stop for people that were visiting.
It's what I normally show. Like, whenever I was touring, I'd take the bands I was in there, and they would just be like, what the fuck? Like, why do you live anywhere else? And I'd be like, aha!
That, and as overpriced as McNally that does Balthazar and Pastis and those places.
Oh, the French place.
Yeah, I mean, they're totally snooty and, like I said, overpriced, but they're so damn good.
I mean, here's the thing. Mastro's is overpriced, but it's fucking awesome.
Yeah.
So sometimes, but then there's the opposite. There's actually that French place, Malice, in Santa Monica. I'm sorry to anyone listening, but it's so fucking expensive and worth much less.
Yeah.
I just outed a restaurant. I'm an asshole. Anyway, we're so punk rock at Waldman's Words, we give a fuck about what restaurants
think.
There
goes that sponsorship.
Yeah, they were totally going to sponsor the fuck out of this show. Just so everyone listening knows, and then we're going to talk about Chris. Emily and I do not get paid for this. This is for the love of the game.
Much respect.
Thanks, dog. All right, so Atlantic Records. I mean, were you there? You were there just after... You know, you were there before FBR, right? Because I know that Paramore was one of the bigger ones there at the time.
No, Riot was, like, killing it right when I got there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it just celebrated its 10-year. So isn't that freaking nuts how time marches on?
2007.
It's crazy. So talk about it, because I believe was, and correct me if I'm wrong, was Mayday your first signing or what else? Because I know that you worked with, I believe, Circa and Mayday, but I want to learn more because this is interesting to me, believe it or not.
Yeah, Atlantic was awesome. You know, we had a killer A&R. Remember to scoot up. Atlantic was awesome. It still is. We had a killer A&R department. You know, I remember, even though I'd been at a major label for a minute before, I was kind of, I had been shepherded from the kind of gnarly politics that do exist at those companies by Pete and the guys at Epic.
Right.
So joining Atlantic was like, definitely getting thrown a bit more into the fire, and I literally
and out come the wolves.
I literally remember my first day walking into that building, and like my armpits were sweating. Like you know, going up to my office on like the 20th.
Your first floor. New York job.
Yeah,
it's an intimidating city.
Yeah, totally. But you know, I learned the hustle real quick.
But you're also more established too, so you had more quote unquote to offer as opposed to being the shepherded kid who's literally, like, just sucking it all in.
Yeah, totally. So, Yeah, I signed Mayday Parade there. I signed Circa Survive.
Which, for the record, the Circa record is my favorite record they put out.
Yeah, that was...
Blue Sky Noise, right?
Yeah, yeah. And being able to work with David Bottrell and Rich Costey and just with that band, I mean, they are, probably... I'll be probably the most talented band I've ever worked with.
I mean, I'm so offended by that.
No,
I mean,
just their musicianship is just like uncanny.
All of the instrumentalists can play, and obviously Anthony can sing. So that's something that doesn't happen a lot in quote unquote scene bands. Because sometimes faults are celebrated, and that band can play.
Yeah,
and you didn't offend anyone listening.
And then I worked with a band called Fighting With Wire from Ireland, which I'm so bummed never really got to see the light of day because I still have their record, Colonel Blood.
Was it shelved?
Queued up. It came out, but it might as well have been shelved.
Dude, I've never even heard of that band.
Yeah, I'll send you the link. But
sick.
It's very like... it's very 90s, very, like, right now, if it came out, it would probably, with the 90s revival happening.
It's a 20-year thing. Like, the Killers were huge at that time, and that was 80s.
Yeah, but they had, like, elements of At the Drive-In, elements of Nirvana, elements of Husker Du. It was, and just a rad three-piece from Ireland. So I worked with them, and then, what else did I work on? I worked on a band called The Cab that was on Fueled by a Woman.
I'll Run.
Yeah, and it was really cool.
They opened for Lido Beach at the On the Rocks.
Nice.
Yeah,
really, and
the Cab did. I know that's where you chime in.
Sorry,
no,
like
it's fine.
The Cab
people
a lot.
Love them.
Yeah,
and they actually, I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, they had an MTV show that never came to be, correct? Because I feel like they had cameras around them at that show.
Yeah, that's they're another incredibly talented group of guys who I believe I just ran into a producer the other day, Dan Bronstein.
Who's part of Rolling Artists.
Yeah, who's working with Alex De Leon, the frontman of The Cab.
Bones, right?
Yeah, Bones, exactly. That's his project. But, I really got to enjoy working with them, but also getting to know John Janik throughout that process.
FBR, baby.
Because he's,
And now Interscope.
Yeah, just absolutely killing it. But a really interesting thing that I learned, interesting, but like just important thing that I really learned at Atlantic was the element of putting artists with like outside songwriters. Because it's not like they didn't do that at Epic, but I really got like kind of thrown to the wolves with that, like with Mayday Parade. And they knew that I think in hindsight they would have not like to have done it, but they knew going into it, it's like, look, we're gonna try to make you guys the All-American Rejects. We are going to like try to get you on Top 40 Radio.
It's part of the game. Therefore, with the major label.
Yeah, it's like, it's, you know, it, you would think it's stating the obvious, like you're signing with this company that's got 250 people, not 15. So
investing a lot of capital.
A lot more mouths to feed and a lot more risk but reward. But that was my boss Pete Gambarg. He's exceptional when it comes to just like he knows every writer and he's just constantly doing.
He's dialed in.
Yeah, he made most of the American Idol records for RCA before he came to Atlantic, and majority of those are all co-writes. So put Mayday Parade through the ringer on that record.
Anywhere but here, correct?
Yeah, and. It was, it turned out to be a good record, I mean, it's their least favorite record, but...
it's the quote-unquote fans' least favorite. I like it. I actually make people playlists, and I put The Silence on someone's playlist the other day.
Yeah, and Kids in Love was a great
Kids
song.
In Love is catchy. The video is not safe for work.
No, that was kind of like a bit of a Hail Mary attempt to, like, just get some shock value going, because the song, I think it literally got to, like, number, like, 39 on the radio charts, but
better than number 40.
It is what it is. So after being at Atlantic for almost 4 years, it was time for me to move on. The cool thing about Warner Music at the time is it had this incubator system called ILG that worked with like labels like Triple Crown, Hopeless, and Fearless, and throughout that process because we also had tried to sign the main. I mean, there I could go on and on about bands that we tried to sign mm-hmm. that we didn't get. I mean, the biggest one was the Gaslight Anthem, which was...
Side One.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we were trying to sign them before they even signed to Side One, because that was something that was like, if you did A&R and didn't know that what was happening with that band in New Jersey, then...
And you were right
shouldn't have been doing A&R. Yeah, it went from them selling out, like, the Knitting Factory at, like, 300 Cap Room to, like, Bowery Ballroom at, like... to like two nights at Terminal 5, which holds like
pre-signing.
Well, like at the first,
because they were a Stone Pony band, correct?
Yeah, weren't they? Yeah. Anyways, where were we going? Oh, so throughout the process of working with those other, I always had like a more of a of an indie label kind of like let's say mentality, but taste wise, you know. I mean,
Static Jax, dude.
Yeah. I mean, I like pop music, but like, my forte is not signing like a pop solo artist and then like architecting a record.
Mm-hmm.
Another artist I did sign at Atlantic was Little Boots, which was, she was signed to our affiliate Elektra over in, we signed her to Elektra in the States, but she was signed to a label called, I forget what it was, I Am Sound or something like that. But she was kind of like, you know, like a little bit Kylie Minogue, mm-hmm. like pop, but like had like a dance, like, you know, element to her. And that was a fun record to work on. Cause
I can't get my head around you, man.
Yeah. So towards the end of my tenure at Atlantic, I was also kind of ready to move back to California.
Were you over the grime of New York City?
I just like always said, like, unless I just had my ultimate like dream job and or, you know, fell in love with, like, you know, the love of my life, then I'd probably move back. Mm-hmm. I also, that had been, like, marked about 8 years being at, like, corporate companies, and I just didn't see myself continuing in that path. You know, I just, some of the politics and bureaucracy and whatnot, it's not that I didn't have the passion or, like, the fight in me to do it, but, like, at that point, I was talking to some, you know, boutique publishers, boutique management companies.
Oh, you might have even shifted out of the A&R game.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to be doing A&R in some capacity, meaning, like, either...
You but know, for a label.
Yeah, exactly. I might have shifted out of the A&R, the label A&R game. But I had developed a really good relationship with Bob Becker, the owner of Fearless Records, because even though, you know, Mayday Parade didn't blow up, like... he respected the fact that we kept Fearless like very much in the loop of everything and involved them throughout the whole process. So Bob wanted to, you know, not take a backseat approach, but I think he was a little bit burnt on doing a lot of the nitty gritty of A&R. Mm-hmm. I had heard through the grapevine he was looking for a potential new employee, and I remember vividly calling him from my New York office being like, look, like, my contract's ending here soon. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm looking to move back to L.A. potentially, and I heard you want an A&R guy. He's like, well, you've got good intel because you heard right. And I literally was on a plane a week later, flew out to L.A., down to Huntington Beach, met with him and the staff, and like another week went by, and I got an offer. And then I started working there a month later. But it was cool because he let me... You know, I still had a lot of roots in New York, so I worked for Fearless for probably, like, the first 8 months out of my New York apartment.
Oh, that's cool. They let you, because getting out of a lease in New York is not exactly the easiest thing to do.
Yeah, and, like, you know, I had, like, you know, my life was there, you know, like, mm-hmm. a lot of my friends and just the whole deal. Then went to work at Fearless, which was a great change from, I mean, in all
major
aspects,
labels.
Yeah. I mean, it was totally different, and I was, you know, I had more experience than, you know, most of the people there, aside from a couple who had worked at other labels, but most of them were interns that had been groomed from the ground up.
Right.
But I also, you know, one thing about living in New York is that I didn't get to surf, which I used to love to surf.
You could have surfed in my hometown of Long Island, you
know. Well, Fearless's office at the time was literally, the address was PCH, you know.
You could jump in the water.
PCH Avenue. Yeah, I would go surf before work, and, you know, our balcony would overlook the water. So, It's a great change of pace. Pierce the Veil was a band that I was actually looking at signing to potentially Atlantic at the time.
Because their EVR contract was almost up?
Yeah, okay. It was coming up. And their manager at the time, Brett Baer, also managed Mayday Parade. And he knew
that... And a Hoobastank.
Yeah. And 18 Visions, who I worked with. I didn't sign them, but my boss, Pete, worked with them.
And they're back.
Yeah, they put out a record on Rise recently. Yeah, rewind. The Pierce the Veil guys, when I played them for Pete at Epic, Sony had some type of deal with Equal Vision, and Pete brought them to Equal Vision. So I never claimed to have signed Pierce the Veil to Equal Vision, but I...
You had a hand in it.
Essentially helped them get that deal. So I had had a relationship with those guys for...
And you jammed with them. 15, so yeah. So you had the homie relationship,
yeah,
too.
Love those guys. So part of, like, you know, Bob's kind of, not joke, but, like, we'd say, like, all right, well, when I get to Fearless, like, I want to sign Pierce the Veil. Like, we'll get it all wrapped up with a nice, you know, ribbon and bow. But, yeah, Pierce the Veil was the first band that I signed to Fearless.
Not a bad start.
No, I wish I could say it. I had architected it that way. But, I mean, I knew they were going to do well, but none of us knew how fucking big they were going
to
get.
To this day, I've seen NSYNC. I've seen Britney Spears. I've been to some very teeny boppery shows. I've never experienced a louder crowd than Pierce the Veil at the Wiltern when Chiodos was taking Sleeping with Sirens a spot, another... Fearless band, Tonight Alive was on the bill, and Hands Houses. And I honestly, like, I wear earplugs now at shows. I should have worn it from the crowd. They were treating them like they were the Beatles.
Yeah.
It was exceptional.
Loyal fans, too. For
ardent.
Years. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, yeah, they paid their dues, and they were kind of, I don't want to say band, because I don't want that to sound, like, insulting, but, like, you know,
Like Circa, they have the musicianship to back it up.
Yeah, and like a lot of these bands, like Day to Remember and Bring Me the Horizon, Chiodos and Mayday Parade, like almost would like kind of envy the fact that these guys would go off and shred and write like 5-6 minute songs when they were doing like the more traditional type songs. But so that paid dividends huge when it came time and they wrote a record that was, you know, a much more
Collide, dude. That I mean, I know a lot of people name drop Selfish Machines, which is great, but Collide front to back, it's
just
perfect.
Was like, it was the perfect storm at a perfect time, having Kellen guest vocal on King for a Day. I mean,
tag
it just,
team.
It was just great. So
and you actually worked with Corniff as well, correct?
Yeah. Corniff was David Bendith's one of his engineers.
House of Loud.
Yeah, House of Loud. And I met him through the Mayday Parade process. And when I signed Pierce, we didn't have the budget to do a Bendith record. So I hired Corniff to do it.
And it paid off.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, you know, I just talked to him on my way in today. Him and I are good friends. And yeah, it's been cool to see him kind of grow throughout that process. And
that made him a name, that record. Before, he was more of the sideman. And that record, I mean, that's how I found out about him. So, yeah Collide was great. And I remember because that year that I saw them at the Wiltern was 2012 when the record came out. And I believe Pierce the Veil was one of the top Warped bands. So they closed out the last show. They were that band. And it's just insane to see that. So... props to you and Fearless for that, and now you're at Epitaph, so let's talk about that.
Yeah, it's been, it'll be a year in Thanksgiving, so...
Mazel tov.
It's been awesome, man. I mean, like you, you know, if the 13-year-old Chris Voitel would have told me, like, hey, you know, in 18 years...
That's the verbiage I use.
You're going to be working for Epitaph Records. I would have laughed in my own face.
But not only working for the label, literally being the tastemaker there, being the guy.
Yeah.
It's so cool, and I grew up literally on Epitaph Records, and they consistently deliver, so...
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a collaborative effort over there, which I love, but... Yeah, I mean, working for Brett Gurewitz has been, you know, a dream come true. He's just such a he's such an icon, but he's also just such a normal,
down to earth
dude,
man.
Too, yeah. You don't have to feel like you're walking around eggshells around him. It's been great, and we've signed. We've hit the ground running.
Quicksand, dude.
Yeah, Quicksand. That record's coming out in what is it coming out? summer release is coming out in the fall. It's coming out at the beginning of November. Converge is coming out a week later in November. The World is a Beautiful Place. He's putting out a record.
I think I'm seeing them at the Echo with Roswell Kid.
Yeah, so there you go. That's coming out at the end of this month. So yeah, it's been really exciting. There's certain bands I can't talk about just because, you know, the ink's not
and
dry.
We will not.
Yeah, but let's just say I'm really, really excited about, you know, the roster that we're cultivating over there.
Next year could be a big year.
Yeah, yeah. We have a lot of stuff that's in the pike. And, you know, Anti, which I don't, you know, have a ton of responsibilities and stuff that I do for that label. They've got their own A&R mm-hmm. and whatnot, but they've got, you know, an amazing roster as well. And they're putting out a bunch of Tom Waits vinyl, an artist named Curtis Harding, who's this soul singer from Atlanta who's just freaking great. Danger Mouse did the record, and Mavis Staples, they're putting out a record. She just did the Hollywood Bowl.
Pretty sweet. Yeah, that's kind of a big deal, the Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah.
So, Emily, because we're going to wrap this up really soon, Emily tells me nothing but good things about working at Epitaph, how it's just a really friendly, chill, and professional, non-corporate vibe. So I just wanted to say thank you all at Epitaph for treating her really well.
Yeah, thank you guys. Me too. I'm sure I'll extend that my last day is in 2 days. And I hope
you do. That's free advice. Thank them.
Yeah, I mean, like, literally, I think, like, well, I don't think. I hope I don't butcher what, like, Brett's main ethos was, but we had obviously, you know, gotten to know each other for years before I started working there, but I remember my first day in the office, he brought me down and was just like, well, you know, I know we've talked a lot about the company, but, like, just to kind of solidify, reiterate, what have you, what the core values are is, like, we work for the artists, we treat people nicely, we have fun, and probably not in the right order, and we strive to, like, do good deals but do artist friendly deals. I'm like, okay, I think I can.
That's a good mantra.
Yeah, I think I can work here.
As opposed to the robber thing that you talked about with A&R before.
Yeah, I mean, that was.
But I think what's cool about Brett is that he started as an artist and he became an extremely prolific producer, so he gets both facets. And obviously, I don't know the exact beginnings, but he was completely DIY with it, and now look at their catalog today.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he's a true, you know, renaissance man of all things, especially music. And, yeah, I mean, he's built that thing into an empire.
From the ground.
Yeah.
So, Emily, I think your adjective suffices.
Yeah, I think it was a good one.
I think
I'm gonna
it was
stick
a great
by
one.
It.
Well, I own your adjective. I'm going to own the chill one. And I guess, Chris, before you sound off on ways to check out various Epitaph artists, if you can give the people listening in bands that are starting now or have been around for a while, what is the one thing you've learned over your career that you would like to impart to them?
Hopefully this doesn't sound cliche, but
cliches, I mean, are cliches because they're true sometimes.
No one's going to work harder for you than you. That's the biggest thing. But I feel like if bands haven't figured that out by now, they're either just completely in the clouds or they're not in bands. Because it's just, you know, with the advent of you know, the internet and just how easy it is for bands to record and get their music out there, which I think is a good thing, because I always support, you know, artists, you know, trying to, you know, promote their art and you know, make a living out of it. At the same time, there's that much more competition and that much more muck to cut through. So, yeah, I mean, it's hard to kind of summarize it in one.
We'll do another show another time.
But yeah, I mean, you know, you just have to hustle, because. Yeah, otherwise you're going to get left in the dust pretty quickly.
Well, I can extend on that point as an artist manager. I'm not going to want to really get behind a product if you're less than A-plus into it.
Yeah.
So that's my stance on that. So, Emily, I want you to do this. How can people check out Epitaph Records?
Oh, well, we're online as Epitaph Records. All of the artists that he mentioned, people like Mavis Staples have stuff. The World's a Beautiful Place has things coming out.
Propagandhi, I forgot that one's coming out.
Propagandhi,
soon.
Yeah.
Canadian Shredders.
Yeah. Of course, they're also going to go on tour if they aren't on tour already.
And they're definitely not a controversial band.
No. So, yeah, but if you go onto Epitaph Records, you can see all the artists and see what's going on with them. So there you go.
And I promise you I will at some point. So, Emily, before we give the man to my left a shout-out, I just want to say thank you so much for killing it this summer. I will miss you very much, and I'm sure we'll talk in about 5 minutes. Chris, another fist bump. I think you did mad decently.
Yeah, give a little shout-out. Well, thank you for having me on your show. It was a good time.
Sweet. So every single Tuesday, 5 o'clock our time, 8 o'clock. Actually, no, that is Pacific. See, I'm just mad decently worn out. 8 o'clock Eastern time and Sundays, 5 a.m. when Emily is just getting out of the club, and 8 a.m. when Emily is still getting out of the same club for some reason.
It's a long, long time. Yeah.
It's a sick long line.
Waiting for my Uber.
Yeah, and Philadelphia Ubers are kind of shitty. So thank you guys so much for tuning in, and have a great night.